Hey, everybody. Ashley Adamson here alongside our fabulous executive producer of the pod, Betsy Bloom. And Betsy, I'm excited for today. So excited for this conversation. This is something that has been, well, I guess like months in the making. And we finally get to talk to the wonderful Rachel Wegner.
You know, it started back in October. Ashley, you sent me a Medium article that Rachel had written, and we'll link it in the show notes. Everybody, you should stop now and go take a second to read it. Actually, it's more than a second. And that's sort of the point that I think we're taking away here is that we need to hold space for other people's stories. And that's exactly what we did here with Rachel. So Ashley, I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about our back and forth.
The quick backstory of how this came to be. So as you mentioned, it was back in October. We had just started the second season of the pod. And we're kind of finding our way, right? Like both of us are trying to figure out what this season's going to look like. And you and I had just started working together. And I sent you this Medium post that my dad's friend John had shared with me. And the title of the post was "To Be a Jew." And Rachel Wegner had written it shortly after the October 7th attack by Hamas on Israel. And it's a eloquent, beautiful, honest, heartbreaking account of what it is like to be Jewish in the wake of everything that happened on October 7th. And as Betsy said, before you listen to this, or if you're driving right now and can't go and actually read this, I just urge you to go spend some time with this post. It is linked in the first line of the show notes. And there was so much, Betsy, that she said that really hit me. And the very first sentence, "I believe in the power of stories to bring people together." I like stopped in my tracks because I had written down on this little yellow sticky note that is still on my desk, something that you had said that totally hit me when we were on the phone, which is "we believe in the power of stories to bring people together." And I'm like, what's going on right now?
Right.
And so, you know, when my dad's friend reached out and offered to me connect with Rachel as a potential guest for the show, on the one hand, it seemed like, well, of course I should call her. But Betsy, as you can attest, like it took me a lot longer to actually make that call. And if I'm being totally honest, just the hesitation I had around wading into the topic of the Israel-Hamas war and all the public discourse and vitriol surrounding it, it scared me.
Yeah, I mean, it scared me too. And I think that one of the reasons that Rachel's Medium post really resonated with me is that it wasn't, and that's why I said take more than a minute to read it, because this is a conversation that requires more than a minute to understand. And in this time where everything is just distilled down into easy yeses, easy nos, black and white, I think that what we ultimately decided, Ashley, was like the point of this podcast is not to have a political position, but to open up space for people to tell their stories and to go a little bit deeper. And that's what Rachel did in her post and what I know she'll do today.
Yeah. And I just, it was, because that was the thing I kept thinking, like, number one, we've never covered a topic like this on our podcast. We're mostly mom content and storytelling. But two, I just, to your point, I did not feel qualified to weigh in on something that I didn't feel well-informed enough about. Like I've read a fair amount of the coverage, but this is not my wheelhouse. This is not my specialty. But I just want to say before we bring Rachel on, like, thank you for helping me zoom out. And I just give you all the credit for encouraging me and kind of repeating this sentence about, yeah, this isn't about having a full understanding of the history of the Arab-Israeli conflict. This is about like the unbelievable power that stories have to bring people together. So I'm grateful that Rachel decided to share her story because, as she'll tell us, it created so many connections and many that she didn't even expect. And I will say, after my first phone call with her, I just felt like, holy cow, man, this is somebody that I'm supposed to meet. It's somebody I'm supposed to know, and never would have crossed paths with her if A, she hadn't shared her story, and B, you hadn't helped encourage and nudge me along. So thank you for that. Okay, Rachel is a teacher by trade. She's currently working in the San Diego County Office of Education right now. She has three daughters. She's a wonderful storyteller. And without further ado, I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Rachel Wegner as much as we did. She is a special woman with a really wonderful perspective. And thanks as always for listening. Rachel, it is so great to be here with you. Thank you so much for making the time.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm super excited, a little nervous, but more excited and just ready. Like, let's talk.
Talk.
It's such a special space. Like, who gets space in their day to just talk and tell stories? And I'm so honored.
Beautifully said. And we're honored to have you. And yeah, just have it be all excitement, no nerves, because I can tell from the conversations we've had, you are terrific and your story is amazing. I gave the background of how we initially got connected and the impact that your Medium post back in October had on both of us. But before we totally dive in, I do like to start with, set the scene. How are you coming into this? We're recording on a Monday afternoon. How are you doing today?
Today I'm good. I'm great. I had a nice, easy morning. It was a morning where both parents were home. So, school, getting everyone off to school was a little easier today. I didn't have any meetings. Got to walk my dog. And it's sunny in San Diego for the first time in weeks. So wow. I'm feeling good.
When you think about why you decided to write this piece, and for those who are listening who haven't had a chance to read it yet, they will, I'm sure, by the end of this conversation. But why did you decide to write it, Rachel? And what did you hope to convey?
It was really quite selfish, actually. I wrote it as therapy for myself. I had just lived through a really intense week, the most intense week of my life to date. And writing's always been my therapy. And so all week long, kind of the story just kept snowballing. And I just kept holding on to all of these pieces and all of these, the story, not just of me, but of my community and of my friends and my kids. And I got to the point by the end of the week on Friday night, I just thought, I'm ready. I'm ready to talk about what's been happening. I'm holding on to this resentment that nobody has asked about what's happening. I know better than to just call people out and be angry, right? I know people need to be called in and that there needs to be an invitation first. And so I want to make this the invitation. I spent Friday night writing. I usually go to bed pretty early. I'm in bed by 9 or 10. I stayed up writing that night, probably till 3 in the morning, just because I had so much that I wanted to convey. And then by the next day, I shared it with a couple of close family members, got their blessing, got my mom's critique. And it was ready to go. And then it spread far and wide, way farther than I ever thought it would. I meant it really, like I said, quite more as a cathartic exercise and also to share with family and friends what had been going on. I never expected it to go as far and wide as it did.
What was the response? I mean, I know you said it was beyond your wildest dreams, but who did you hear from? What was it like? Because I'm sure it was even with all the critiques, and the blessings from, you go put it out in the world. I'm sure there were some nerves putting something like that out, a piece of you.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I will say so on Medium, you can track stats, and I laugh a little bit because I can see that there were over 11,000 people who viewed it and 7,000 people who read it, spent more than 30 seconds. And so, I laugh because in that second paragraph, I very explicitly say who this is for and who this is not for. So I like to think that 4,000 people read that second paragraph and were like, yeah, nope, this is not a story that I am interested in. So they moved on, which is fine. I heard from people all over the country. I heard from people connected to people. I mean, like you, Ashley, right? There's, 7 degrees of separation, but we connected through a kind of a long channel of folks who had read the piece. I heard from Jews. I heard from non-Jews. I had all of these, I'm not really on social media, but I suddenly had all these Instagram connection requests and Facebook requests and new followers on Medium, which is unfortunate because I don't actually really write very much. I think it touched people in a way I never expected it to, right? I had written it as my story, not realizing how much my story would connect with so many other people.
Rachel, we've talked about this a lot for this podcast, which is something that you said resonated. You said, I wrote it for myself, and then it ended up touching a lot of other people. And we've talked about that a lot. If you do something for yourself, if you do something that you yourself love, the authenticity of that will be attractive to other people. And it seems like that's what happened. And I was really struck by that first sentence, which hopefully everyone here has gone and read the post. But if they haven't, it starts with, I believe in the power of stories to bring people together, to build bridges, and to create connection. So I'm just interested in sort of how you got to that sentence as your starting point.
I don't know how I got to the sentence. I can't ever start writing unless I have my first sentence and unless I really believe that my first sentence is powerful. So I've been wanting to write a sequel, but I don't have a good first sentence, so I haven't written it yet. I think that really just came to me because it was true, right? That was my motivation for writing. I had a moment, I think it was probably during COVID, where I had a rare moment of peace and I was sitting on my couch thinking about the world. And I noticed a book on my bookshelf that I don't know if you've read, Where the Crawdads Sing. And it was a really beautiful book about a part of the country I had never known anything about, a part of North Carolina. And it just, I just had this thought like, wow, when I read, I really have insight into other people's experiences. And, you know, I'm like, I'm in my mid 40s. This is not the first time I've had that thought, right? I've, Betsy, like you, I, you know, English major and English masters and taught English for a long time. Like, I believe in the power of stories and of reading. But this moment when I was sitting on my couch and I just thought, it's when we tell stories and when we can, when we have enough space to hold other people's stories, that's what solves world problems, really, right? Because that's what builds relationships. And the clarity of that thought, I think I've just held on to really dearly since then. And so when I was thinking about writing and I was thinking about my why, I wanted to claim my space to tell my story because I believe that stories are the solution. Maybe not to everything. I don't typically try to speak in extremes, but I think stories are a solution.
I could not agree more with you on that, Rachel. And I think it's where you have to start, because that's where understanding, it's where all understanding happens. And I think the fact that when you talk about the response and all the people that reached out to you from all over the country, like that brings to life your first sentence, like stories do connect people 100%. Yeah. And one of the things that you said when we were talking, and I kind of want to ask both of you guys this, but you had said, Rachel, that it's really been over the last few years that you've started to form a deeper connection to your Jewish faith, your identity, being Jewish. What, give us a background of like what your experience was growing up. How big of a role did Judaism play or not play when you were a kid?
Yeah. You know, the first 10 years of my life when my parents were married, I don't really remember a lot about being Jewish. My dad was not Jewish. My mom was, but wasn't really practicing. And then when my parents separated when I was 10 and we moved in with my aunt and uncle for a few months, they were Orthodox, modern Orthodox. And it was, I just remember it being a really sudden transition into who was in my life and how customs and rituals and traditions fit into my life. And it was temporary, you know, it was a few months kind of while our family resettled in different spaces and in different locations, and found our new balance. But that was the first time that I was exposed, I think, to a really Jewish life. And we would do holidays and all that, but we lived in Arizona. My family, the rest of my family, my Jewish family lived in California. So it wasn't, they're just, I don't remember a lot before then. And after that, my younger siblings started going to religious school. They went through kind of the traditional path of Sunday school and having their bar and bat mitzvahs. And I didn't. I was at that point, you know, a moody teenager who wanted to do my own thing, my own way. And that wasn't a part of how I saw myself. And so it wasn't until high school, you know, and at that point, after the divorce, we were back in California, back with family. And so again, the holidays and the things really became the way that we celebrated. And we were affiliated with the synagogue, but I didn't love it. It wasn't until I was 16 and I decided, you know what, this is a part of my identity. I was trying really hard to be Latina. I was learning Spanish. I was like making all my travel plans to go pretend I could be Latina and have some aspect of a culture. And then I realized that actually I did have my own culture. I just hadn't adopted it yet. So when I was 16, I did kind of the fast track to my bat mitzvah, the simplest version possible. And I chose that for myself. I went to Israel with a teen group. And then frankly, I kind of fell away from it again, right? I went off to college. I had some Jewish friends, but I wasn't super involved. And it really wasn't something, I married a lovely man who's not Jewish also. And so it really wasn't until my oldest was 10 or 11. And my husband had, you know, my husband and I had always agreed that our kids could be Jewish if they chose and they would get to choose whether or not they'd have a bat mitzvah. And at some point it struck me that they can't really choose if they don't know what they're choosing between. Mm-hmm. And so we joined a synagogue. We were very lucky that right after we joined, we got a new rabbi who was young and energetic and amazing and a huge social justice advocate. And he really, you know, in a congregation of thousands, he really helped draw me in particular. It's now been a few years, but our synagogue now is really our second home. And this is not something I ever, ever would have expected myself to say.
That is a wonderful, kind of beautiful story. Yeah. And I wonder, Betsy, because you and I have talked about this before, but I'm not sure we've talked about it on the podcast. Does any of what Rachel said resonate with you? Because you actually grew up going to Catholic school. What was your experience?
Yeah. So my father is Jewish. My mother is Catholic. And I think, you know, to lean into a stereotype, I often feel like the moms are more like the drivers in these scenarios. So my mom was like, I want her to go to Catholic school. My dad was like, okay, I don't really care. So I have always felt, and I don't have children yet. And so I do wonder how this will manifest when and if I do have children. But I have always felt really connected to my Jewish identity. Like for me, that part of my heritage has always been so important. And I think what you said, Rachel, about like, that's my culture has resonated so much. So I would say that my dad and I bond over being Jewish through food and humor. And I love that those are the things that I associate with that part of my heritage and my culture. And I also think that for me, storytelling is inextricable from my Jewish identity. And I feel like one of the things that I love about being Jewish is that we are such a resilient people. And I think story is intrinsically connected to that. Like we have told stories that have kept us alive, kept our culture alive against, in some situations, sometimes against all odds. And I wonder for you, Rachel, do you feel like storytelling is connected? Do you, as an educator, as a writer, does that feel connected to your Jewish faith at all?
Yeah, it does. And I've thought about this a lot because that piece didn't come to me right away, quite frankly. When I think about how I came to the stories and believing in the power of storytelling, it was through other ways, but it really is the essence of being Jewish. And I was at a really beautiful community event this past weekend on anti-Semitism and, you know, in globally, nationally, and also locally. And there was a Holocaust survivor who spoke. I believe his name was Abraham Foxman. And he said, the reason the Jews have survived so long is because after each tragedy, we stand up and we say, I still want to be Jewish. And we tell our stories and we move forward with the resilience that our stories give us. But he talked about like the Greeks and the Romans, and after the destruction of their massive empires, nobody stood up and said, I want to be Greek or I want to be Roman. And I don't know if that's entirely true, but the message that came across is that, you know, a large part of both the culture and the religion, which to me are separate things, are about remembering where we came from, right? And reflecting on where we are today. And then, you know, thinking also the hope for moving forward, right? It's a piece that's woven in, I think, in really subtle ways sometimes, but it really is every time you go to synagogue, you listen to a story, right? Every Friday night, the rabbis tell a story and they connect it to the, you know, to our modern situations. Our holidays are all about telling stories. And then I think just, you know, off the way we engage in dialogue also, there's a lot of storytelling.
That's a beautiful thread that I hadn't even really made that connection. And I just wonder, it kind of brings up this point and one of the most powerful things that you said in this piece. And again, there was so much in there that struck me, but I'm just going to read this small section for and then have you react to it. But you said, the Free Palestine movement has continuously made me question whether I even have a story to tell. Isn't the true injustice the Palestinian oppression? Isn't their suffering more important? How can I make this about me, a white woman who walks through life with many privileges while Palestinians are living their own horrors? You go on to say, every time Free Palestine surfaces, I find myself not knowing what to say and questioning my right to take up space with my story. So I stay mostly silent. And then this time you said was different. You go on to talk about the gaslighting that you finally saw for what it was for the first time. And I know, Rachel, that part of what you wrote really resonated with several of my Jewish friends who I sent this post to, who felt like they didn't really necessarily feel like they had the right to stand up to say anything. So just, can you walk me through that feeling and what you discovered about the way society had been sort of making you question or invalidate your own experience?
Oh, gosh, it's such a big question. I will try my best. I think that what happened on October 7th was so, I'm going to cry. it was so extreme. And it was so, you know, it was like a 9/11 moment for me, right? I will forever remember my daughter, my 15-year-old, who found out on Instagram what had happened, and her coming to me and me like, you know, I was busy. It was a Saturday morning. I was running around doing things. And I remember so clearly the things that she said that made me stop in my tracks. And I don't often stop in my tracks as a busy mom and wife and worker and all of the things. And I froze. And I remember thinking right then and there, like, this can't be, right? This is history. This isn't something that happens today. And it was so horrific and it was so awful. And then right away, the celebration of what had happened surfaced, and not just on the fringes and not just on the extreme, but in, you know, in mainstream social media and in mainstream news, you were seeing these protests and people celebrating Hamas fighting back as resistance fighters and fighting against oppression. And it was so crystal clear to me that that's not what happened at all. And Hamas says in their own words that that's not what they were fighting for, right? They were fighting to murder Jews and to exterminate Jews. And that's what they were calling home and bragging about and celebrating. And when I felt throughout that week, the intensity of my experience growing, and at the same time, feeling like my space to actually communicate about what was happening for me and people I loved, that space felt like it was shrinking. That just led me to a whole other train of thought where I really had to think really critically for myself about why I started to be scared to speak up, that what I was experiencing was legitimate, that hard evidence was there. And so why was I so scared? You know, I've done a lot of work in the DEI field. I've done a lot of personal learning and reading and thinking about things like oppression and colonialism and white supremacy and doing my where I fit into all of that. And so I had already partially been on this journey as to, you know, how I as a white Jewish woman fit into this space in America. And I realized that all of the tenets of white supremacy, that these DEI movements, and I'm not even going to say movements, that I had been working against and organizations that I had worked for, and you know, that my colleagues and my friends were in these spaces with me where we were really working to broaden the way that we interact with others, and to like heighten our awareness of the ways that we are conditioned to interact by society and the ways that we can learn to see systems that are in place that we might not otherwise see. And I all of a sudden realized that all of that was actually happening to me, that this time I wasn't participating in that as a white woman, but actually I was on the other side of that as a Jewish woman. And I think I started to be able to name for the first time, like I write about it in my piece, but this idea of either or thinking instead of both and thinking. What I've come to now is I think the challenge for people is that it's fairly easy to understand a system where there's an oppressor and people who are oppressed. And that's pretty, you know, there's A and there's B, and this is how they function together. And so that's can be easy to understand. And when we're talking about Jews in particular, they are an oppressed people with many privileges. And so how do we hold that contradiction? And how do we, like going back to the quote that you read, how do we hold the idea that Palestinians are oppressed and Jews in their own way and in a different way are also oppressed? And in order to really understand that, you have to lean into this nuanced thinking where there's space for two oppressed peoples to be at odds and to be able to understand. When I say oppressed, I want to go back to this idea of like oppressed in different ways, right? I think people are pretty clear on what happens in Palestine that leads to oppression. I think people are far less clear about Israel and why Israel was created and why it exists and what it means to the Jews today and what the Jewish experience is in Israel and outside of Israel. That's a much more nuanced definition of oppression. It's easy not to be curious, right? When there's an otherwise clear-cut way of understanding it that's being presented, that's the way I think we want to lean into, right? Instead of grappling with the complexities of it all. That was a really long answer.
It was unbelievable. I was just going to say, like, you didn't just try, but you described that, I think, totally beautifully. Rachel, all of these ways, and then so much, Betsy and I did a episode with Chantal around this idea of binary thinking and that we just as humans try to put things in a box, right? Because it just makes it easier and cleaner, and let's stay out of the gray area. Let's just know that this is good and this is bad. And it helps our little, like, you know, kind of lizard brains try and make sense of the world around us. You know, what advice would you give about engaging in like these deep interpersonal connections, especially now in the age of social media and social divisiveness and people who are virtue signaling, like all of these different things? You don't know whether to say something or not say something. What advice would you share, given your experience and the experience of actually writing this piece, for people who are trying to figure out what to do and what not to do?
You know, I want to say first, I don't know that I'm one to give advice to anyone, so I'll answer it for me. I understand pretty clearly that social media is not a space where I can engage, because it's a snapshot in time, right? Social media, there's snapshots of opinions, there's snapshots of stories, there's snapshots of experiences, and they're extremely curated. And those are not the forums to have any sort of intentional dialogue. I think there are forums for learning, and there are people you can follow and organizations you can follow to learn. But I don't think they're the spaces to engage in conversation. And so when I think about the advice that I give to myself, it's about being curious, right? And it's constantly pushing myself, how can I stay curious in this moment? And if I genuinely am curious, then what am I going to do about that, right? And which viewpoints am I willing to consider? Which viewpoints am I missing out on? And why am I not willing to engage in those? And that's all self-work, right? That's hard self-work to do. I've had a lot of friends ask me, you know, after they read my piece, their apologies. I didn't know. I'm so sorry. I have been thinking about you. I just didn't know what to say. And that them saying that was perfect, right? Because that opened the door that I needed. And particularly when it comes to being Jewish, right? You know, I shared, I came to my Jewish identity more strongly, more as an adult, when I don't connect with my friends as often, right? I still have many of the same best friends I've had for a long, long time. But when we were forming our friendships and when we were growing up together, being Jewish wasn't a huge part of that. And so for many of my friends, this is a new piece of me that's been added to my story that they don't really know about. And so it's fair that they don't know to ask, right? But in them asking and asking, who can I follow? What can I read? What do you suggest? You know, the things I come back to are like, I'm happy to tell you what to read and who to follow it based off of my opinion and who I think does a good job of sharing a really nuanced view. But also I just want you to ask questions, right? I want you to look at the stories that are being told, and I want you to be curious about what's missing.
Rachel, I hear so much of what you're saying, and it resonates so much with me as an educator, because I feel that we are always trying to tell our students to think critically, to scratch below the surface, that they should reject easy answers, that if something is too easy, then there's probably something missing. And so I have been really disappointed in this idea that, like, if you try to add nuance, that you are then, that's the wrong answer. And in my mind, looking for nuance can never be the wrong answer. Being curious can never be the wrong answer. And I think a lot of the rhetoric that's been used around this is like Nazis, right? Like, it's like, now who X is the Nazi? And it's so easy to say something like that and be like, well, because that was so very clear. Of course it was. Of course we can say Nazis were evil. And yet to say that every single person that participated in the genocide that happened to the Jews was just innately evil is too easy. It excuses the fact that humans can engage in horrific acts, because we're basically like, well, that was just a flaw in that specific area. And so to me, like, I see that we are lacking nuance now, lacking nuance looking back, and it's really heartbreaking. So I find it so, sorry, I'm rambling, but I really find it so important that we are always pushing that, always saying, be curious, ask questions.
Yeah, that resonates so, just so deeply with me. But I have so many questions for you as an educator. Like, so what do you do about it? You know, I really want to know.
I was just going to say, I really would love to hear from both of you how you both dealt with and continue to deal with this conversation, because I think nuance is so important. And in the space of a classroom, there's more opportunity, but you're also dealing with a lot of different families and viewpoints and all of this stuff. So I know it's not easy for teachers and educators right now. So Betsy, I'll start with you. Like, how have you been addressing, dealing with, making space for any of this?
Yeah, I think that, Rachel, you mentioned social media. I think social media is so awful in that way because by its very nature, it has to present things in bite-sized memes, GIFs. These are by their design meant to be easy to digest and swallow. Mm-hmm. And so this is what our students are working against. And I also think that sometimes they are lacking nuance in their conversations at home. And despite this, I still feel like young people are leading by example. My students are able to have complicated conversations, to hold multiple things. I heard one of my students in a conversation, we were learning about the history of Iran, and she went, well, it's not black and white. It's more complicated than that. And it just made me so – this was a freshman. I was like, how many adults do you know that could say that, that could acknowledge that there were wrongs that the U.S. government had committed and wrongs that the Iranian government – my point being, I have faith and hope, actually, because I think that despite all of that, they have this innate ability to have not been settled into like one camp or another in anything. Mm-hmm. Rachel, what do you think?
I love that so much. I mean, that it makes me smile, a great big smile. Yeah. I'm right there with you. I think part of why I believe in education and why I've, you know, spent my career in education is that I do, let me back up a minute. I think one of the things my parents always said to me is that if you turn out better than me, then I know I've done a good job. And so far, they tell me that I've turned out better than them. I don't know. I don't know how we're comparing, so I don't know that I can agree or disagree. But this, I think for me, it's this concept of, you know, when we know better, we do better. And so as adults, we're always growing and learning, hopefully. Let me personalize that. As an adult, I am always growing and learning, and that is essential to who I am and who I strive to be. And as I grow and I learn, I know better, and so then I can do better. And if I can create spaces for young people to be growing and learning to know better so they can do better, then we raise up this next generation to be better, right? And if we're going to continue to compare across generations. And I think that education spaces, those are some of the only spaces that we are given in life to be able to lean into complex conversations and to understand even what nuance means, right? And to have somebody push us to see what's here, what's not here, what needs to be here.
It's interesting, you guys. I was talking to my dad about this just yesterday, and we were talking about this exact thing of just hopefully every generation is getting better than the one before, even though we all think that like, oh, kids are ruining everything. I really believe, but then I said to him, and he goes, I was just about to say the same thing. Then why aren't we perfect yet? Like, how if we, if every generation is supposedly learning and getting better and becoming a better version, and it's because we probably can't listen to our parents as well as we should, and we have to go learn all these hard lessons for ourselves. But I want to circle back on something that you wrote, Rachel, that's related to this, but you said that you wrote this piece during the darkest week of your life. And many months later, here we are. It's not, you know, every night the front page story or leading the A block on the news, but the suffering and death and loss and grief and trauma is still ongoing and so real. And I think it speaks to like what happens in our society all the time. We see it with gun violence, right? Something horrific happens. We spend a few weeks feeling horrible, calling for change. News outlets cover it like crazy. And then eventually everybody gets back to their everyday lives. And I know you have so much going on with full-time job and raising three daughters. How are you handling like that push and pull of needing to focus on what you can control in your own life and not being able to just sit here and take in the news all day long, but also not just pushing it out of sight, what's still happening over there?
I do have to work to keep it front and center. And I do that consciously. I do that because it continues to be my community and my people and brothers and sisters, figuratively and relatively, who are heavily impacted. And if I'm not paying attention, then who is, right? And if I'm not learning the nuanced stories, then who is? There's that beautiful quote that it just starts with, if I am not for myself, then who is for me? And it goes on to talk about being for others as well. And I think that's why I continue to have to stay engaged and lean in. And so I do follow the news, right? I don't follow American news. I follow news from Israel. I follow a very kind of niche group of reporters in Palestine. And I follow a lot of Jewish organizations who are putting out really complex stories frequently about what's happening on all sides, both internationally and locally. And I do that also because I need to keep my family safe, right? I need to keep my kids safe. And when there is a protest and a die-in at the local mall that my teenagers go to, I want to know that that is happening so that I can advise them on, you know, whether or not that's the mall they should go to today. And if they do go, this is what is happening currently that they will see, and they need to make some decisions. And so there's a very real safety factor in there for me. I feel like I'm forgetting a part of your question.
No, I think that's spot on. And I guess just to add on to that point of, it's one thing for you to take this in and to understand your role in it, but you're a mom of three daughters who are at very formative ages, right? What, 10, mm-hmm. 13, and 15? Is that?
Yeah. Yeah.
So how do you talk to them about it? How are they doing? What's the, it's different when it's your own kind of weight to bear within your community, but as a parent, I can imagine there's so many more layers.
There really are. You know, my kids are all, they represent elementary, middle school, and high school. And so there's a lot of variation in how they understand this moment in time. And, you know, I let their questions lead the way often, unless there is something local that's happening. But I also, particularly with my oldest, and maybe I need to be doing more of this with my middle daughter as well, but I ask very explicitly, you know, what's come up for you lately around this? How was Jewish Club meeting? Is anything being said? She had an experience. She was with a teen group through synagogue. They were in Washington, D.C. for a weekend of learning about the political process and lobbying. And it was a really amazing weekend. And there was a large, you know, there were hundreds of teenagers that were there, and they were all out in their little groups in Georgetown, having a lovely Saturday evening. And she and a very small group of friends came across a Palestinian protest. And her friend who was in front of the group kind of stopped everybody and said, take off your name tags and hide all of your Jewish identifying jewelry and things like that. Their name tags had them, you know, as part of this religiously affiliated group. And so they did. They all paused in this group of 10 teenagers. They hid their Stars of David. They took off their name tags. And then they turned around and they walked a different way to get to where they needed to go. In, you know, in Georgetown, when it's 20 degrees and it's pitch black outside, and they were given parameters to stay within, and they had to reroute themselves because they feared for their safety. And I share that just because, well, one, I think it's an important story to share. But also because as a mom, she needs to know that she can come tell me that, and that I will react in a way that helps her feel supported, and not in a way that maybe makes her feel more scared or invalidated or dismissive or any of the other things. And so I really try to create space for my kids to know that they can share their questions and their worries and their concerns. And I might not have all of the answers. I write in my piece originally that when the day of rage, you know, was imminent back in October, that I spent my evening telling my daughter she'd be safe. And we both knew that that was kind of, I don't even know how to describe it, but that wasn't necessarily true, right? And I try not to promise my kids things that I can't actually promise them. And then sometimes as a mom, you say what you feel you have to say. I don't know.
When you think about parenting in general, and you said something to me when we were on the phone the other day that is related to this, but it was about a totally different topic of some different stuff that you know, as a mom that you deal with and going through different things with your child. And you said something that it totally hit me like a ton of bricks. So I would love to just ask you about this. And you've been so generous with your time. I know we could ask you about 100 more things and learn a lot more. But when you think about understanding that your child has their own story that you are not authoring, but you are learning and you are a part of, because they're going to go through things that, you know, you can't predict and you don't know. And each journey is so unique. So what have you found from, you know, the phase of parenthood that you are in now with teenagers, young adults, and it's such a hard time, especially for girls in that age, about understanding your child's story.
Well, you know, I guess nod to English teachers here, but I think of my role as being the graphic organizer.
Yeah.
Right. Here's your structure. Here's your setting and your environment, and here are your life circumstances. And, you know, what are you going to do with that? And you get to fill in the details. There are definitely times where I would love to author my kid's story, right? And I want to jump in and I want to email this teacher, or I want to call this friend's parents, or I want to walk with them and hang out behind them at the mall, right? To be there to author what might happen in the way that I think it needs to happen for them. But that's not helpful, and it's not realistic, and it's not my story, right? And we all know that, right? I think as adults, we know that we grow through our experiences, and part of the reason that you're home for the first few years of your life are for you to have a support system, hopefully and ideally, to help you through moments that you have to learn how to author for yourself. I try very hard to make it my job to be the side character, right, in the background, the supporting character, watching the main characters carve their path. And it doesn't mean there aren't hard conversations. It doesn't mean that there aren't parameters and guidelines that are set that I adhere to very strictly, and I make them adhere to. And there's consequences when those are not followed. But there are always conversations about the why. There are always conversations about values. And when you make these choices, does that help you live a life that aligns with who you want to be? And if not, then what are your other options?
It's almost like she's, you know, been on this podcast since the beginning.
Yeah, we just had an episode about side character energy, Rachel.
I didn't listen to that one, unfortunately. But that, yeah, that's me, better. Maybe in a nutshell, side character energy.
Well, I think that what you just said, gosh, it makes me so, I think this is a big part of why we feel like future generations are improving, because we are improving and we're passing that on. But that is my question for you, is this something that you learned from your own parents? Is this something that you learned because you wished you had it from your own parents? I think, you know, with this podcast, especially, we think about what does it mean to be a mom and how do you take what's in your own life, what your own parents taught you. So I'm so impressed by that attitude. And how did you come to it?
I think a lot of it was modeled for me, and shout out to my parents that in the midst of some really difficult circumstances, this sounds wrong when you say it, but I think they did an amazing job.
I agree with that.
I'm not quite sure how to praise them or compliment them, but I feel like I turned out okay. My siblings are amazing. So we'll leave it at that. I was definitely raised in households where I was given parameters and then a lot of trust to behave in ways and make decisions in ways that fit within those parameters. Actually, one of my favorite stories is that I was in high school and my parents would ask me what time I wanted to be home or what time I was going to be home instead of giving me a curfew. And so that I was out at a dance and I had said, you know, I'll be home by 11. And I got home by 11 and the door was locked. And, you know, it's 11 o'clock at night, the house is asleep and I have no way of getting inside. And so it's, you know, my date had to take me to the 7-Eleven, to the payphone out in front of the 7-Eleven around the corner because there were no cell phones. And I had to call many times to get somebody to actually answer the phone and let me in. But I share that because there was a lot of trust that I would make the right decisions. And when I didn't, or I'm going to say more specifically, when my siblings didn't, then there were some meaningful conversations that happened. And I was the oldest, so I got in the least amount of trouble. I do think a lot of it was modeled. And I think a lot of it, I think just being an educator and learning how to work with different personalities also really helped. The more you're exposed to kids and in particular kids who are working through who they want to be and kind of that identity development, the better you get at learning to sit back and listen and being there to support but not to drive.
Well, I just want to underscore the fact that your parents did do an amazing job. I don't know your siblings, but I have the
small amount
that I've been able to get to know you. It's just, yeah. It is wonderful. And I guess just kind of two last things for you. One is we usually try and give a shout out to or make space for people to get specific in a shout out to their own mother. And so I would just ask you maybe the thing that you admire most or that you learned from your mom that you'd want to share.
Yeah, I'm a shout out to my mother who just this morning told me that I'm so busy and that I do so many things and my kids aren't going to be around forever, to which I said, I know. And it's because sometimes my kids and my role as a mom is so all encompassing that I have to do all of these other things because I'm not just a mom. So we had a lovely little conversation about that balance. But you know, my mother has always been, she has just always been there. And now I will cry again. You know, she didn't have it easy. She didn't, I don't know when she's ever really had things easy for her, but she is the person that I call many times a week. And when I don't call anybody for a long time, she's the first person that I call when I get back on track. She knows everything. She's had many careers, and she ended her working career as a college librarian, which was such a perfect career for her because she does know everything and she knows how to find everything and she knows how to fix anything. I think just her strength. She's so strong in many, many ways. And actually what I have had to learn is how to be a little bit less strong and learn to rely more on others. And that's been its own journey. But my mother's strength is, there's no words to describe it. But it's admirable beyond belief.
I love that. And I love what you said about the strength that is also required to ask for help and lean on others, because it is not innate, I think, in many of us. And we want to be able to do it all and carry it all and hold it all. And it actually, I think, takes a lot of strength to be able to ask for help or let go and make space for other people to help. Because it takes a village. It takes a village.
Yeah. It really does. I want to share one last thought that's a little bit related, maybe. You know, I was listening to your last podcast about with Martha Thomas and her daughter Ella. And it was such a beautiful podcast and relates to the work that I do. And we've talked so much about stories, right? And the importance of sharing stories. And I had this moment where about halfway through the podcast, when you asked how she found out that Ella had died, and I shut it off really quickly without thinking. I just kind of went, nope, I'm done. And I haven't gone back to it. And so I've done quite a bit of thinking this week about why I had that reaction and what that means. And I think what I've realized, and I hope that I remember how this connects to what you just said, because this was what reminded me. What I realized is that I only have so much space to hold other people's stories. And if I have a story that needs to be shared or needs to be held by someone else that's taking up space, then I don't have what it takes to bring in other people's stories. And I think that's what happened in that moment, that I was on my way home from this day-long conference on anti-Semitism, and I was holding so much in that moment. And the first part of that podcast was so lovely, and it was so much joy, and that I could carry, right? That I could lean in and I could listen to. And then we got to these heavier moments. And I think what happened was that I just couldn't hold that and hold my own at the same time. And so when I think about what that means for storytelling, it brings me back to the idea of, like, how are we taking care of ourselves? Who are we leaning on? Who are we saying, hey, I need you to listen and I need you to hold my story, because then I can create space to be in community with others and hold their stories too. And I know for myself, I'm not good at talking about things. Surprise. And I hold a lot inside, and it takes a lot for things to come out. And it's in those moments when I'm holding a lot that I shut down and I turn inward. So I've been thinking about that a lot.
I really appreciate you sharing that.
Myself, yeah.
Yeah. And just, Betsy, I wonder if you've experienced any of that as well in your own life, but I am someone who, and like all things, my dad always says this too, like, your best thing, your best trait is intrinsically linked to your biggest weakness. And I think, mm-hmm. I like to think of myself as a very empathetic person and someone who really wants to absorb and be in these feelings. And when someone's feeling something, I feel it very deeply.
Yeah.
And that is a wonderful trait. And I don't ever want to change that. And sometimes it's just too much. Like you can't hold, there's not enough space to hold it all and for everyone. And it's something that I just recently am starting to understand in a different way of having to create some, I don't know if boundaries is the right word, but just you can't take it all in and you can't hold it all, even though I would if I could, but I'm not going to be helpful to anybody if I do that. So I thank you for sharing that, because that is, you put that exact feeling in just a really eloquent, concise story that I think is important for people to hear and understand. Betsy, do you have any, I feel like you are one of the most empathetic people I know as well. So I just wonder if you've had that feeling or realization.
That was really a light bulb moment for me. I feel like I always learn so much just from listening to these conversations on this podcast. And so, Rachel, I just want to thank you, because we hear these phrases, especially as teachers, over and over again. Like, you have to put your own, air mask on first. You need to – and it's always like you're like, yeah, okay, when I have time. And they're like, but you can't help others unless you help yourself. But gosh, like that is so – I will now pay attention so much to the moment where I'm like, I can't. And I reach those moments, and that's not good for the people around me, because I haven't had that pressure valve release. And I have just now recognized a huge part of why that is, because you're just taking so much in from being a mom, being a daughter, being an educator, being a person whose job it is to ask other people's stories for a living. And if you don't take the time to share your own, then you're not doing anyone any favors. So I just want to say thank you.
Yeah, no, I don't know how you both do it. I mean, Betsy, you're still in the classroom and in times like today, right, where I think things are harder than ever for teachers. And Ashley, you know, you're running a storytelling. Well, you both are running a storytelling podcast, and you are absorbing all of these stories all of the time. And it's tremendous the way that you do that. And it's a beautiful space that you offer. So thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And I appreciate both of you endlessly. Just one last thing, because, you know, one of the reasons we did want to have you on at this time, it's always important to have these conversations. But I do think when you look at next week is Passover, which is one of the most celebrated, you know, holidays in the Jewish community. Do you have any special Passover traditions or stories you would like to tell, or maybe just offering what the holiday means to you?
Well, my mother always makes us do a play.
Yeah, I we really have, like your mom.
We have zero actors and actresses in the family, but we have a lot of kids. And so every year she finds a script for us to read to really act out the story of Passover. And she assigns roles. And, you know, there's always competition about who gets to be God. And it's usually all the non-Jewish husbands. For me, it's an interesting holiday, because it's both very joyful, right? It's often the first time that we've gotten together as a family since the holidays. And so there's always a sense of joy, and I don't have to do any of the cooking, which also brings me joy. But then there's also, you know, there's very much this undertone that every year we are reflecting on a history of oppression, and we are reflecting on may next year be better. And these last few years in particular, I have felt that in such a heavy, heavy way, that in the midst of joyfulness and hope and talking about the future, things have been getting harder and harder in terms of being Jewish and what that means for me personally, and what I want it to mean for my kids. And yet, as we think about those things, and as I hold whatever recent experiences we've been having in the Jewish community, right, I'm sitting around a table with my family, and we're pretending to be the voice of God, and Moses and all of the characters. And it goes back to Betsy, what you said about that hope, right? There's so much hope and there's so much resilience, and it is the storytelling holiday. And so this is, I think it's a perfect time to release this. So
I could not love that more. And I think that is wonderful. Your mom, like I said, sounds amazing, and acting out and plays. It's something that my kids and the cousins have just started to do in a real way. And it's amazing, like, what it brings out. I'm like,
oh, yes.
It's really cool to see how into it they are and how much work they put into whatever it may be. So I love that. Thank you for sharing. And I will just say, I know in your bio online, I think in LinkedIn, one of the first sentences is, I believe education is freedom and it is the key to the Jewish concept of tikkun olam, which is Hebrew for repairing the world. And I first came across that phrase thanks to my good friend Yogi Roth, who I work with. And I just, you are doing that in all of the ways of being in the education space, of working around suicide prevention, of being a mom, of being a storyteller and a writer, and I know a daughter and a wife. And I just genuinely feel so lucky to know you. And thank you for sharing your story, because I said this in the open, but like, I feel like we were supposed to know each other. And I'm really glad that we do. And I hope this is the first of many more conversations to come.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much to both of you. It's like I said in the beginning, it's not often that I get invited to just talk about myself or share my story or feel comfortable doing so in the span of any given Monday or any other day of the week. And I appreciate this so much. And now I can go back and finish the episode of the last podcast that I didn't. So you have helped me create some space.
Oh, we love you, Rachel. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Well, our deepest thanks to Rachel. And, you know, Betsy, I just think about, I had hope for what this conversation could be and would be, but didn't really know. And she just blew all of those expectations out of the water. There was so much in there. It's like hard to kind of pick out one or two things that resonated the most, but I'm so grateful that we got connected to her. I'm so grateful for you to encouraging me to reach out to her. And I think just one of the things that immediately comes to mind as I'm spinning back and thinking about all of the amazing things she said was about this notion of learning our kids' stories and not being the author to them. And as a parent, sort of you know that rationally, but how hard is it to actually execute that in the real world and know that kind of they have to go through their own path and you're there to help provide some of the structure and the elements. I love that analogy for English teachers out there, but that you're not there to author it. You are there to learn about it and to bear witness to it. I thought that was absolutely beautiful.
Yeah, that really resonated with me too. And I, as I mentioned, I'm not yet a parent, but gosh, this podcast, I hope, is just every time I learn something that I think will make me a better parent. So thank you, Rachel, for that. You know, Rachel mentioned in her Medium post, and she mentioned on the pod today, that she didn't feel qualified to share her story or that she didn't feel worthy even to share it. And Ashley, you mentioned this at the beginning of the second season, but that is the point of this season of Your Mom in so many ways, is instead of asking, who am I to share my story? It's who am I not to share my story? And something that Rachel said was just opened my eyes so much, that sharing your story is actually an act of generosity and not an act of selfishness. So I hope that you go out and share a story today so that you can make space to hear other people's. That's my takeaway.
That is a beautiful takeaway and so eloquently said. And I think that, not only is it not selfish to share your story, it is also a form of self-love, I think. And talking about what you need in order to help make sense of the world is to first kind of think about and understand and appreciate your own story and your own journey. I am such a big believer in that. And once we know that our stories matter, like we know that our lives will matter and the impact of all of that. So our thanks to Rachel. And I'll just say, if this conversation impacted you in any way, please share it with people you love. And I think Rachel's words are going to have a lot of impact for a lot of people for a lot of different reasons. Betsy, I love you. I'm so grateful for you. I appreciate the space that we always get to make together, and we'll do it again soon. But please subscribe. It always helps. And we'd love to hear from you. Email yourmompodcast@gmail.com. And we'll see you next week.
See you next week.